Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray. Drop
what you're doing! When you're talking about the politics of budget cuts, first of all, you have to realize that until government is actually starved of revenue, no budget will ever be cut. Budgets will be rejiggered. Revenues will be reallocated. Funding will be redeployed. But budgets will never be cut until governments are starved of revenue, which is one of the reasons why I find myself grinding my long-suffering teeth into powder whenever I hear somebody who's a disciple of the Arthur Laffer School talk about the supposed benefits of tax cuts, including more revenue for the government. I scream. I say, no, you tax, forgive me, you cut the tax, preferably abolish it, but at least cut it, and then you aggressively cut spending, because the real cost of government is the spending. Taxes, of course, are a very important, overt, tangible way of knowing that government is sucking you dry, because you can feel it siphoning away your life and your livelihood. But government spending, the size and expense of government, that's the real burden of government. If you want to know how much government is costing you, look at what it's spending, because it's taken from somewhere. It's taken from you through direct taxes. It's taken from you by way of excise taxes, indirect taxes. And the most insidious form of tax, of course, is inflation. Even when prices don't go up, inflation is still a very important part of the equation. Prices don't necessarily have to go up all at once, but you know what? And I find myself digressing once again within a digression. Probably before the end of this year, we're going to hit a really nasty inflation shock, because that bearded nitwit who's running the Federal Reserve, the guy who once said, I can just hear the smugness in his voice as he said this. I've read the transcript. I've never actually heard an audio recording of the address from, I think, 2002. Ben Bernanke is the man we're talking about, for those of you who may not know, who said that the government has this wonderful technology called a printing press. Well, at some point this year, those printing presses, or their digital equivalent, are going to be let loose, and we're going to have a price inflation shock that's going to be in some measure a reflection of the actual monetary inflation shock. Now, the circulation of money hasn't gone up as dramatically as it could, because the Fed is inflating like mad, but it is inflating and then giving the liquidity, as it calls this quantity. I don't know if the word quantity can be used to describe something that exists only in the virtual realm, but we'll use it. Giving this quantity of what we're told to call money to politically connected banks, and they're sitting on it. They're not making loans. They're cutting off credit. This is not the bad kind of credit I'm talking about. I'm talking about debt. I'm not talking about addictive levels of easy debt. I'm talking about operating capital for people who need short-term financing in order to operate businesses that are vital for a modern economy. Long-haul truckers, for instance, just to take one really important example, people who are in the business of long-haul trucking, they need short-term credit in order to carry goods from point A to point B. And if you don't have that, you go out of business. And it doesn't matter whether you don't have it because you're no longer creditworthy or because credit is simply not to be had. And the latter is the situation that confronts many people in that industry, and it's a vital, indispensable industry. But the Federal Reserve has been creating huge volumes of inflation, and then the banks are sitting on this. And I think the reason they're doing this is because they're anticipating the big buyout. They're anticipating that period that I believe Richard Doughty, the so-called Mugambu guru, has spoken of. As a matter of fact, he spoke of it with me back in 2005, of a period when they literally can buy everything because nobody else is going to have any money. I mean, that's one of the things that happens when you have a depression. is that eventually the only people who actually have access to money and to money and to credit are the people who are connected to the government that has collapsed the economy, and that's the sort of prospect we're looking at right now. But back to the subject of budget cuts. One of the things that happens every time you're talking about cutting a budget, be it a municipal budget, county budget, a state budget, or the federal budget, is what has been referred to as the National Monument Syndrome. What's the first thing that goes? Well, they find large, symbolic, well-beloved institutions or objects, and they close them down. Oh, those heartless skinflint Republicans. Of course, they may be heartless, but they're not skinflint. Oh, if only they were skinflints. The heartlessness we can stipulate to, unfortunately, the parsimony is not part of the package when you're talking about Republicans. They're just as big a pack of squanderlusts as the commies that run the Democratic Party. In any case, those heartless skinflint Republicans, they're forcing us to shut down Yellowstone Park. They're forcing us to close down the national parks. We're forcing us to close down Statue of Liberty because they won't do a deal and save these vital institutions. In other words, we're going to start attacking those things that will result in anguished, hand-wringing editorials and headlines. We're going to cut the school lunch program. We're going to find a place in the budget that will exact the maximum amount of PR-friendly pathos, and we're going to cut that first. You know, we're not going to go after the salaries, perks, benefits, pensions of the tax-feeding class's apex level. We're not going to be cutting the benefits for congressmen, for legislators. We're not going to be going after all the many amenities that they enjoy. Nancy Pelosi is not going to have to surrender her jet, that kind of thing. We're going to go after the most vulnerable, the most harmless, and the most beloved things. Well, there's a different version of that game being played now as we find ourselves careening. I'll have to Google the poem, and I'll share it with you probably in the next segment. But ringing, ever ringing down the descending roofs of change. Change being, of course, the worship word for the Obama cult. Suffer these crimes in Oakland, don't call the cops. Oakland's police chief is making some dire claims about what his force will and will not respond to if layoffs go as planned. This is from the Bay Area in California, the NBC affiliate. I'm trying to find the name of the affiliate, and it's not here. Anyhow, Chief Anthony Batts listed exactly 44 situations that his officers will no longer respond to, and they include grand theft, burglary, car wrecks, identity theft, and vandalism. He says if you live in Oakland and one of the above happens to you, you need to let the police know online. Some 80 officers were to be let go at midnight last night if a last-minute deal was not reached. That's about 10% of the workforce. I came here to build an organization, not downsize one, said Batts, who was given the top job in October. Among the other crimes they will not respond to, embezzlement by an employee, extortion, attempted extortion, false personification of other, injure a telephone or a power line, interfere with the power line, unauthorized cable TV connection, vandalism, administer or expose poison to another. And then you go up to, once again, such very important crimes as grand theft, burglary, car wrecks, identity theft, and vandalism. In other words, they're no longer going to be able to respond, or at least they're not going to be permitted to respond if you find yourself being a victim of one of those crimes. Negotiations are going on at Oakland City Hall in the mayor's office. Batts said the 80 officers slated to be laid off, mostly new officers, are pretty sad and pretty depressed, and those feelings are shared by the police department as a whole. Well, you know what? There's a lot of that going around all over right now. I find myself sad and depressed very frequently. And the thing is, I'm not living at somebody else's expense as a government employee. The Oakland City Council voted June 25th to eliminate the positions to help close the city's $32.5 million funding gap. According to the City of Oakland, each of the 776 police officers currently employed at the Oakland Police Department costs around $188,000 per year. Many of the officers who would be left affected by the layoffs were on the streets of Oakland when Johannes Mercelli's involuntary manslaughter conviction caused riots last Thursday. Now, just a second here. The 80 officers slated to be laid off, mostly new officers, each of which costs OPD $188,000 per year. That's starting salary and benefits in Oakland. Don't you think maybe they could gear that down just a little bit? $188,000 per year. You're dealing with people mostly in their early 20s, mid-20s, at the outside, maybe people in their 30s. $188,000 a year? That's salary and benefits for brand new police officers. Anyhow, here's the National Monument strategy being used in a slightly different way. It's outright extortion. Give us what we want, or the police will let you suffer. They're not the only ones to do that. I'll give you another example on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a minute. So we see this new gloss, this new riff, on the old National Monument strategy. National Monument strategy, once again, is the term that I've given, probably somebody else has beat me to it, to the familiar budget negotiation tactic of finding something that is beloved and conspicuous and would be the focus of a great deal of public anguish, and making that the target of budget cuts whenever there is discussion of reining in government spending. Oh, they're going to have to close down Mount Rushmore. Oh, they're going to have to shut down Yellowstone Park. People are going to have access to the Grand Canyon. Nobody sits there and thinks, now, wait a minute. Why is it that the government runs all these things to begin with? Maybe they should simply sell these things off, and chances are they'll be managed better, and we wouldn't have to pay for them. We'd have access to them on a fee-for-service basis rather than simply having our wealth plundered for the benefit of the people who were controlling these things. Or, in the alternate, you cut the school lunch program, then you parade these desperate waifs in front of television cameras. That's what happens every time there's some discussion about reining in the budget. Now we're seeing the revenue-producing element, the enforcement caste of the tax-supported class, that is to say, police officers, union police officers. Just very quickly, I'm going to window into another digression here. Why is it that so many conservatives who have little, if any, patience for organized labor, why can't they see that government police agencies are a union enterprise and they're just as obnoxious as any other labor union? At least they should be from a conservative perspective. Anyhow, police unions now are playing the same game, and the union reps, the union honchos, who are police chiefs and, unfortunately, county sheriffs, are playing this same game in a way that is very, very dangerous. Here in the city of Oakland, their new police chief is simply saying, here are 44 kinds of crimes I'm no longer going to allow my officers to respond to, and they include some really serious crimes that put life at risk as well as property. If there's any excuse for having police departments, it's to protect life, liberty, and property. That's a Romans 13 proposition. That is the only reason why you would pay to maintain a government, is so that people in exercising that delegated, limited authority would wield the sword against evildoers to protect the innocent. If we're going to be afflicted with a government, it should be limited to that function and that function alone. Here you have the police chief of Oakland simply saying, no, these things are optional. But paying $188,000 a year for brand new, freshly minted tax feeders is not an option. So give us our $188,000 a copy for 88 costume tax feeders, or we're no longer going to be responding to these kinds of crimes. Here's another really good example, and this is the way this issue is treated by Tim Kavanaugh on the Reason.com website. Some of you might be familiar with Tim Kavanaugh as a stand-up comedian. Mr. Kavanaugh is a species of libertarian political commentator as well. I say species of libertarian political commentator because he tends to be a little bit too Republican-flavored for my palate. Nonetheless, this is a very good summary of another example of the same type of extortion. The headline is, "If you don't give us 150% pensions, we'll kill this child." That, of course, is a variation on the famous National Lampoon cover from the 1970s in which a dog is shown sort of leaning away from a 357, a 357 Magnum pressed up against its skull, and the headline says, "If you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog." Now, this is how Mr. Kavanaugh summarizes another version of this same tactic in Sacramento. "Ever wondered when a decline in crime rates that is now well into its second decade will produce the law enforcement version of the post-Cold War peace dividend? Never seems to be the answer from the Sacramento, California Sheriff's Deputies Union. The murder rate in cash-strapped SACTO, Sacramento, is the lowest it's been in nearly 40 years. Yet, when county supervisors considered slowing the growth of public safety budgets, the Sacramento County Deputy Sheriff's Association hit back with a hilariously over-the-top ad featuring a girl in what looks like a Girl Scouts cap being menaced by a brawny male hand." And there's a picture of that advertisement in this piece. "Your child's safety is at risk," screams this advertisement. "Sacramento County supervisors set to vote on your safety. Don't let them cut deputies and put your family at risk." USA Today writes up the event as follows. Another ad shows a masked man breaking through a door and asks, "Do you feel safe?" "Safe. We felt it was necessary to grab people's attention," says Kevin Mickelson, president of the Sacramento County Deputy Sheriff's Association. He says 122 deputies were laid off last year, and more cuts would make it impossible to do our job. Chairman Roger Dickinson of the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors says the county's $180 million budget gap means literally no operation is going to be spared reactions. Yet, once again, you see the Deputy Sheriff's Union in this case playing the same extortion card in a much more forthright way. In other words, your family is going to be harmed unless we get what we want, which is a lavish package of salary and benefits and pensions in a time of general economic hardship and depression. Robert from Colorado is with us on the line. Robert, how are you doing this evening? Hello, Robert. Is Robert with us?
Robert? Yes, William Norton.
How are you doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
All right.
Good to hear from you.
Interesting subject that you've already expounded on. I had one subject I wanted to get to, but before I get to that, going back to your discourse about the coca plant and cocaine and so forth, wasn't that also used medicinally back in the late 1800s, like for headaches and stomach aches and things of that nature?
Yeah. First of all, Robert, are you listening to us on the radio? Because there's apparently some feedback going on, just by way of letting you know.
Oh, let me see if I can move. Everything's turned down. Let me see if I can move and maybe clean
it
up a little
cocaine
bit.
Cocaine was widely available at any drugstore, any apothecary, as a topical analgesic, and it was advertised in newspapers and in children's magazines, and often used as a palliative for children who are dealing with sore throats and things of that sort. And that's not something I would recommend. Not that I'm crazy about the government-approved pharmaceuticals that we commonly find in drugstores today, but it didn't turn our godly, pious ancestors into drug addicts. Some of them did develop an addiction, about 4% of the people who tried it. That's pretty common. That's pretty standard for what's going on right now today as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I had an occasion to read an illuminating article by D.V. Kidd this past week on a subject that you've kind of touched on, state pensions, like PERS over there in Oregon and CalPERS in California. Found out that a lot of those pensions are state-funded. They basically take money from taxpayers and put it in some kind of fund and dole it out to retirees from state jobs and so forth. And I think CalPERS works the same way. And she also alluded to unions like AFL-CIO, CIO, Teamsters, Pullman. What do you know about unions, their origin, how they started, how they got their start, et cetera, et cetera?
I know scandalously little about the subject. I do know that they have a protected relationship with the government because, as a matter of regulatory policy in at least two Supreme Court precedents I can think of, they're exempt from the Sherman Antitrust Act, which means that they can cartelize and monopolize a given part of the labor market with the active support of government. And this is something that, once again, represents a government-appointed privilege. And so I'm, by way of disposition, not crazy about unions. I've had experience as a musician with unions. I didn't have a good experience in terms of dealing with unions from the perspective of somebody who didn't want to be part of that cartel. So in terms of where they come from, I think that this is probably an outgrowth of the guild system from the late Middle Age period. But quite frankly, I don't know the details, and I'm not competent to address the subject to the depth that I'd like to, I hate to admit. Robert, would you like to hold through the break?
Yeah, I kind of would. Thanks.
Okay, good. Robert will be back with us on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro-Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, and we'll be back in... So we're talking about labor unions, about public pensions, and about the ways that the government working in collusion with unions, and particularly public employee unions, is wringing pretty much everything out of the economy. And I'm on the line with Robert from Colorado. Robert, you want to take up the discussion from where we left off?
Yeah, really good article. You get a chance to check it out. It's at dvkid.com, but... she was saying, like in Oregon, you've got the PERS, it's Personal Employment Retirement System, and it's funded by the state totally. In fact, people who are involved in it, employees don't even have to contribute to it. They just take taxpayer money, throw it into a fund or whatever, and let it grow however much it grows. Then when you retire at whatever age, you can receive like 50, 60, 70 grand, whatever it's set up at, and it's... It is basically sucking money out of state taxpayers in Oregon, and a lot of people don't know that.
The same kind of things going on in California at a much larger, much greater rate and to a much larger extent. And this is, if you want to take a look at what's going on in Illinois, You've got the same kind of thing, and it's known by various names in all these different states, but you're talking about the same type of a mechanism that's just bleeding the productive dry. And this is something that's going to come down, I think, literally to an elemental warfare between the productive and the parasitical. I think that within, the next couple of years, as things get really ugly, I mean, the makers and takers are literally going to go to war with each other, which is one of the reasons I suspect, and I'm just cynical enough to say this, or cynical enough to believe this, and just unwise enough to say this for public consumption, why the highest priority right now is to make sure that what they call the public safety element of the government is well paid for. And, of course, public safety means the guys with government-issued costumes and guns, because at some point the makers and takers are going to throw down. I just don't see how we get out of that. How we get out of this without some kind of real ugliness on that front.
Yeah, what you're seeing in Greece will probably make its way over here. But let me shift gears to Afghanistan, and then I'll call it a night. As we've talked many times before about Afghanistan, it's really a place where countries go to die. England in the late 1800s, Russia in the 1980s, now America is taking our turn to saddle. We're going to meet the same fate. We're not going to walk out of a place anything close to a W.
Yeah.
A lot of people are going to die for nothing. But I've always wondered, what is it about Afghanistan that makes it such a formidable place to fight? Is it the terrain, the size of the country, the people?
They have a couple of very important advantages. Somalia has similar advantages. Somalia doesn't have the advantage of being crenellated terrain that is just strewn with natural ambuscades. You really can't find a place in Afghanistan where you're safe from an ambush. You know, there's another country that's very similar to that, and that's Iran. It's one of the reasons why I just shake my head and sigh heavily every time people talk about going to war with Iran, for the same reason. I mean, these are natural, booby-trap-laden territories. But Somalia has another advantage that's similar to that the Afghans have, and that's the fact that they don't have one centralized, conquerable government. they're very decentralized. People don't think in terms of a country. They think in terms of a clan. This fellow by the name of Abdel Shams, he's an Afghan expatriate. He wanted to take me to Afghanistan in 1998. I couldn't work that out. But just after Clinton fired some cruise missiles into northern Africa and Afghanistan back in August of that year, I oddly enough, timed to coincide with the announcement of the Monica Lewinsky legal filings, Abdel Shams called me up and said, Will, I want you to come with Afghanistan to me. You don't understand. You can't conquer Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a country. Afghanistan's a place within a map that is populated by this teeming collection of tribes. And so you can't conquer one whole country by simply taking control of one government. You have to go tribe by tribe, rooting them out of the mountains and the caves, and that makes it almost impossible to mount some kind of a coherent imperial thrust into the country and to manage the government on an imperial basis in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the guy who's the cat's paw for the government, or for the United States government right now, basically the Anglo-American elite's government guy in Kabul, is the mayor of Kabul. He's not the president of Afghanistan. He's the mayor of Kabul, and he's only the mayor of a few neighborhoods in Kabul. And so that's to their advantage as well. You've got natural conditions for what's called fourth-generation warfare. They lure you in, they spread you out, and then they win simply by sticking around, knowing that at some point you're going to get tired and leave. The same thing happens in Somalia. The same sort of thing happens in Lebanon. But Afghanistan, like Iran, has the added advantage of the geography as well.
Interesting. That makes sense. Okay, man, keep up the good work. I'll keep listening. Take care.
Thank
God
you
bless.
So much. Great to hear from you. God bless you. I'm not sure whether this is the direction I intended to go. As a matter of fact, I'm sure this is not the direction I intended to go, but I think this is the direction I want to pursue. This is from, I believe, tomorrow's Daily Mail of London. Yes, the dateline is Sunday, July 18th. Troubled Mel leaving the States after selling his New York mansion at a cut price. Mel Gibson is poised to quit the U.S. after selling his mansion near New York. The disgraced Lethal Weapon star, who faces allegations of violence from his Russian former girlfriend, sold the mock Tudor property known as Old Mill Farm for £16 million, £10 million less than the asking price. By the way, that may or may not have something to do with the ongoing scandal. It may be Mel simply cutting his losses because you almost have to give away properties that expensive or any other kind of real estate properties today. The market is just that bad, and it's not as if this is going to kill him from a financial point of view. Gibson has also put his Malibu home, Lavender Hill Farm, on the market for £10 million, according to a property newsletter. He has told friends he will move back to his native Australia with his ex-wife, Robin, who still supports him. Now, that's good. Gibson, 54, is ready to contest the allegations of Oksana Grigorieva, 40, who claims he punched her and hurt their baby, Lucia, in a drunken rage in January. A source close to the family said, Oksana's allegations have united Mel and Robin, and this move is her idea. She is shocked and furious at this woman's lies, and their seven children are shocked. Robin has never seen a violent side to him. She has persuaded him that he needs to get away from Hollywood and find peace on his ranch, and she will go with him along with some of the children. A friend of Miss Grigorieva said Oksana has done nothing but tell the truth. Gibson and Robin divorced last year just weeks after he was pictured for the first time with Miss Grigorieva. A spokesman for Gibson declined to comment. First of all, this is important for a couple of reasons. I am convinced that whatever his sins against his wife and his marriage, whatever sins against God and man Mel Gibson may have committed, he's not a criminal. I'm further convinced that this young woman, youngish woman, 40 is not young, I say that as somebody who's appreciably to the wrong side of that dividing line, this youngish woman, I am convinced, is conducting an exercise in what the Russians call kompromat. She has a history. She has a history of sidling up to wealthy men and then making herself a mistress. And if possible, making with their help a child and living off of the largesse that flows from that liaison. In other words, she is a gold digger. It's pretty clear. She's got a documentable history. One can read media accounts confirming this. She traded up to Mel Gibson from Timothy Dalton, who is another of my favorite actors. I think Mr. Dalton, if those of you in the audience are familiar with the James Bond films, he made two of them. They were both very good, and he was a scandalously underappreciated actor in that role and in others. If you've ever seen any of the illustrations that Ian Fleming actually drew of how he envisioned James Bond in his novels, the resemblance between that drawing by Ian Fleming and Timothy Dalton is astonishing. It's really quite remarkable. He looks like James Bond, and he read the books, and his depiction was, I think, a credible version of what's on the printed page. I've liked Timothy Dalton since I saw him in Flash Gordon, of all the unlikely films, way back in 1979 or 1980. But Miss Grigorieva had a child with Timothy Dalton, and then somehow ended up being introduced to Mel Gibson, and she played the same role with Mel Gibson. And now you've got a situation where there's this selective release of one half of conversations that took place between the two of them that makes Mel look very bad in the context of a highly contestable series of allegations of criminal misconduct. Now, he got himself into the mess, and apparently his wife is getting him out of it and getting him out of the country as well, and I think that's all to the good. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. Come back and join us in a minute or two, will you? Mel Gibson is heading back to Australia. Just very quickly, to give you an idea of why this is interesting to me, I spent a great deal of time talking with Mel Gibson's father a couple of years ago, and he and I do not agree about some aspects of history and some political issues, and for that matter, some religious issues. I mean, he's a very strong sedevacantist Catholic. What does that mean? He believes that the throne of Peter has been left vacant in the Roman Catholic Church. Not that there is no such thing as true Roman Catholicism, but rather what's going on in Rome is not true Roman Catholicism. So he's a schismatic Catholic to that extent. He actually wrote a book, self-published it several decades ago, entitled Is the Pope Catholic? And it's not intended as a rhetorical question. He answers that question with a resounding no. It's a very well-written book, incredibly densely argued book. It involves questions about which I have no firm or passionate opinion, not being a Roman Catholic, but it's a really interesting exercise in argument in defense of a position that Hutton Gibson, Mel Gibson's father, feels very strongly about. That's how he defines his entire existence. He's a very... how best to describe this? He is a very civil, very warm human being. He has been execrated as a bigot, as a reactionary, as a Holocaust denier. He does have heterodox views about World War II. He's not somebody who is likely to be invited to a B'nai B'rith function unless they're planning a blood sport with him as the target. But to the best of my knowledge, and once again, I spent a couple of days talking to him, so I don't really know the man to any extent. The best of my knowledge, doesn't hate anybody. It's just that he has a certain set of views, very strongly held, that are considered very controversial. But he got his family out of the United States after he won a large sum of money on Jeopardy in the 1960s. And they went to Australia. They stopped in Ireland on the way over. They made it across the Atlantic, and he got a job in the British Isles. Then they moved to Ireland before they went to the British Isles. Then they spent some time on the continent. I can't remember where. But they worked their way down to Australia so that his sons wouldn't end up being sucked into the war machine and sent over to kill and die in that exercise of murderous stupidity called the Vietnam War. And he did this literally on a whim because he considered that to be the most important thing he could do to protect his family. Now, the Gibsons are very Irish. And, of course, the bane of the Irish has always been John Barleycorn. That's, as some people put it, the reason why the Irish never conquered the world was because of alcohol. The same could be said about Mexicans. Look, I'm Irish Mexican. God, in his mercy, has made me allergic to alcohol. Otherwise, of course, I'd be a six-pack away from becoming a raging alcoholic. The thing that I find interesting about Mel Gibson and whatever weaknesses and demons he struggles with, and I do think you're dealing with a type of torment that could be best described as demons. He has a son in his early 20s, Mel Gibson does, in this large family, who gets up every morning at about 7 o'clock and goes down to the worst parts of Los Angeles, where he maintains a series of missions to feed and clothe the homeless, the cast-offs in society, the people who sleep in the streets, drug addicts, drunks, people who've made terrible mistakes, people who've committed crimes and are trying to overcome their own foolishness. Mel Gibson has a son who does nothing but minister to these people. Now, I took particular interest in the son, first of all, because as Hutton Gibson showed me the family scrapbook that he'd gotten as a 90th birthday present from his family. As he showed me this, and I looked at these beautiful pictures of all the Gibson kids, the grandchildren from all the Gibson offspring, I noticed that this son really strongly resembles my second son, Isaiah. He looks like a version of what I think Isaiah, my 11-year-old son, would look like if he were twice that age, if he were in his early 20s. And so I had an immediate affinity for him, even before Hutton Gibson very proudly told me what this young man does for a living. And Mel has some other sons who do similarly commendable things. Now, they learned that from their father. And when you hear these carefully cropped and, I think, misleadingly edited tapes with this volcanic outpouring of unfiltered rage and hatred coming from Mel, you have to understand that there is obviously another side to this man, because the woman who just divorced him after over 30 years of marriage, after she had been cuckolded by him, after dealing with his alcoholism and some other problems that he's had, she says that he's not a violent man. She's got no reason to say that, apart from her commitment to the truth. From what I understand, even in the depths of the marital discord, Mel said of Robin, his now ex-wife, that she's a saint, that she's somebody who put up with him and cleaned him up and dealt with him when he was having difficulty. And obviously there was a deal breaker at some point. I don't know whether she's actually a Roman Catholic. I think she might still be Anglican. I can't remember for certain. The point I'm making is that she's offering testimony against interest in defiance of this effort to demonize Mel Gibson as somebody who's completely unfit for civilized life. And she's doing something very worthwhile by getting him out of Hollywood and, quite frankly, getting him out of what the United States is becoming, because he's now a ruined public figure. And that has as much to do with the fact that he didn't disavow his father, that he exercised filial loyalty to his father when an effort was made to attack his family for political purposes. And it's also, of course, a type of long-deferred but inevitable payback for making his film The Passion of the Christ. Now, just a couple of words on the subject of that film. I've not seen the film because, from what I understand, it once again depicts the relevant events from a theological perspective I don't share, first of all. But secondly, even if it were completely accurate, as best that human ingenuity can devise an accurate depiction of what happened as portrayed in the Gospels, I don't need to see that. I've already accepted that, and I don't think that I would be entertained by seeing the dearest friend I'll ever have be treated the way that he was because of my sin. I don't need to see that. I prefer to think of the empty tomb rather than to think of the horrible things that preceded the triumph of the empty tomb. From what I understand, the film ends with a beautiful depiction of the triumph on the morning of the resurrection, which is something I would like to see. But I don't think I need to see the flogging, the scourging, the torture of my Lord in order to understand the artistic points that are being made. But this was not only a film about a sincere, flawed but sincere Roman Catholic's perception of the central Christian event. The hinge point of all history from the perspective of the Christian faith is the atonement of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's more than that, as important as that is, and nothing is more important, but it's also a political act, because Mel Gibson was trying to make a point about man's fallibility and the fact that there had to be a price paid for that fallibility, and that man cannot perfect himself by himself. Now, the defining conceit of modernity, and in political terms, this is where collectivism comes from, is the idea that man can be perfected through the ministrations of exalted people who know how best to apply the magical inducement of coercion. That's the defining conceit of modernity. And against this, of course, you have the Christian message, which is that no, man can only be perfected in Christ's sacrifice. And the purpose of government, to the extent that we're going to be saddled with one, and if you read what Jesus had to say on the subject, he comes a lot closer to being an anarchist than is really comfortable for many conservatives. To the extent that we're saddled with a government, it exists only to protect life, liberty, and property. Life, liberty, and property, to protect us in those aspects, the second great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, it's to buttress and to backstop the efforts that all of us make to obey that second great commandment. But if perfection is to be had, it's in the context of the first great commandment, that's above and beyond the government's jurisdiction. So when Mr. Gibson released that film, went outside the Hollywood apparatus to do that, he was doing something that was a direct attack on modern collectivism, and they're destroying him for it, and unfortunately he's helping them do it. God bless and redeem and reclaim his soul, and God bless his wife for her efforts to try to help him. That's the end of the second hour of Pro Libertate Radio. We'll be back here in just a few minutes on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in just a couple, so stick around.